Our second case for this morning is Farnick v. FDIC, 1116-01. And it looks like we'll hear first from Mr. Brooks.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Lloyd Brooks, and I represent the appellants in this case. And we're asking that this Court reverse the decision of the District Court in granting a 12B6 motion to dismiss our complaint and also reversing the District Court's decision to deny our motion for leave to file a second amended complaint in this action. I'd like to begin actually with a point that was only recently raised by the appellee FDIC in this matter. As the Court's probably noted, that both in its response brief to this appeal and then only a few days ago requesting this Court to take notice of additional authority regarding the issue of whether or not there was subject matter jurisdiction for the District Court.
Right. I wanted you to talk this exhaustion issue, so thank you.
Right. And I think that's a very key point because, quite frankly, it drives home the point that we were attempting to make with our opening brief, which is the FDIC is not our chosen target. The issues that we raise in our complaint are those of the successor bank, MB Financial, and not the FDIC. Yet the FDIC makes the argument that nonetheless we should have gone through the FDIC's administrative process, and that our failure to do so bars the District Court from hearing our claims.
So have you thought of the consequences? If this Court were to remand to the District Court to instruct it to dismiss this case without prejudice on jurisdictional grounds, where would that leave you?
Well, I think it would leave us in a position where we should have been able to go after MB Financial Bank. The administrative issue...
Well, that's going to be a matter of a whole different set of statutes and regulations, whether you can or not.
Correct. And I think the... one of the major thrust issues we take with the District Court's opinion is that it seems to presume a set of facts that aren't in the record. For instance, that the FDIC had the liability for the actions that we're alleging. Well, that's nowhere in the record, and our entire point is if, in fact, MB Financial has that defense, MB Financial is entitled to raise it and bring it forth. That never occurred because the District Court did not allow us to bring MB Financial into the litigation.
So, I mean, if you go to the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation, it does appear that the FDIC is correct about this, though.
That it is the proper party?
Well, that it is, that it has passed along a certain package of things to the successor institution, but not these liabilities.
Well, Your Honor, the only thing I've seen with respect to that anywhere in the record is FDIC attached a copy of a letter that it issued to MB Financial, apparently in connection with a request to indemnify them. Well, indemnifying MB Financial Bank is not the same thing as saying the FDIC is solely liable and that MB Financial is not. It's quite often the case that one party has legal liability for an action but then can rely upon an indemnification contract with someone else to help defray those costs. The problem here is because this case ended on a 12B6 motion, there's nothing in the record to support that that actually occurred. The actual assumption agreement that supposedly exists is not in the record. We don't have that. The District Court didn't review that to determine if, in fact, that's the case. So what we have now is a case that's before you that we don't have any facts to say the FDIC is liable, that the successor bank is liable, or that the predecessor bank is liable. The case was dismissed before that was determined. And the District Court, quite frankly, decided, well, I don't think I should have to look at that because I'm just going to assume the FDIC is liable.
Why isn't that the kind of thing, though, that gets explored through this exhaustion process that didn't take place? It seems to me the first thing that might have been put to the FDIC is whether, in fact, it was the appropriate party for the kind of case that you are trying to bring or whether somebody else is.
Well, the the Act actually covers that, Your Honor, and we point this out in our reply brief in dealing with this jurisdictional issue. FIRA actually sets forth that the FDIC has the ability to sell not only assets, but the liabilities of the failed institution.
Well, that, yeah, sure.
Well,
I think it is the question.
And I agree, Your Honor, but our position is that it did sell those liabilities, and we should be entitled to pursue that theory.
And I'm just saying that you've identified a legal issue, you know, what got sold. Only the assets, or assets plus liabilities, or assets plus some liabilities, or whatever. And I'm asking you why that legal issue that you've just identified isn't precisely what the exhaustion process is designed to flesh out, where you can present to the FDIC, you know, your sale is, as far as we're concerned, something that includes assets and liabilities. So we get to go after the successor bank alone. Because you've already been through this process. I mean, you start out in court, and the FDIC winds up getting appointed as the receiver, and only then does it get removed to federal court. So it seems like there have been moments in this litigation where some of these questions could have been explored.
Well, unfortunately, there was not actually an opportunity that appears in the record for that to have happened, because immediately after the FDIC substitutes in, the case is removed, and the first maneuver is this motion to dismiss. And as Your Honor is aware, ultimately our clients lost as a result of that motion to dismiss. And this entire
But in response to the motion to dismiss, you could have said this court has no jurisdiction. The court would have been obliged to address the jurisdictional.
In fact, Your Honor, that point was raised before the district court. In our response to the motion to dismiss, we identified to the district court that we were not looking to sue the FDIC, that our target was MB Financial Bank, and in fact informed the district court at that point that we intended to amend the complaint. However, we had to comply with the district court's briefing schedule to respond to the FDIC's motion. So we did both. The district court didn't address that until we filed the actual motion for leave to amend, at which point the court said, well, we're going to lose subject matter jurisdiction if the FDIC isn't a party to this case. And I see my time's almost up, so if I can just finish.
That's your rebuttal time. If you want to save it for rebuttal, you're welcome to do that.
And I would like to do that, Your Honor.
Sure. Okay, Ms. Gunning.
Okay, please the court. I'm Kathleen Gunning. I represent the FDIC as receiver for InBank. Under this court's Marr and Capital Leasing case, this court and the district court lack subject matter jurisdiction. As you pointed out, Your Honor, the FDIC succeeded to everything from the bank, including the liabilities that were identified in the complaint.
Why wasn't this raised earlier in the district court?
It was an oversight and error, Your Honor. We apologize. After the succession, we entered into a purchase and assumption agreement, and we did not transfer the liability for the items that were charged in the complaint.
So where is that in the record?
The only thing that refers to that is the fact that FDIC was substituted as the proper party, that we assumed the defense, and the letter that was attached to the motion for substitution. In that letter...
Are you talking about the March 30 letter?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
In that letter, both parties to the agreement agree that MB Financial did not assume this liability. So based on that, there is no dispute as to where the liability belongs.
I have to say, I mean, I think Mr. Brooks has a good point when he says that this all got going so quickly that some of these issues were not properly explored, or didn't really get thoroughly explored, I guess I'll say, by the district court, since each transaction is different. Sometimes liabilities are assumed, sometimes they aren't. You know, it just depends.
Well, Your Honor,
this letter is a little Delphic.
Well, if there is a dispute between the parties, as you had earlier, then there is a need for the court to get involved and to determine who was on first.
And that would be the district court that would have to explore whether the whole substitution of the FDIC has anything to do with what's going on in this case, and perhaps there would have to be a remand to the state court if the FDIC isn't the proper party and it's just a non-diverse state claim?
Well, it's not necessary to try and determine who transferred what, where both of the parties agree that the liability stated in the complaint did not transfer. What you have here is Mr. Brooks.
Where is that agreement? Are you saying that's in the March 30th letter?
Yes, the agreement that they're saying that we both agree, the parties to the agreement, the purchase assumption, agree on the interpretation that they did not assume liability.
This is the matter at issue alleges improper calculation of the Interstate Bank.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Lending rate. Upon review, the actions alleged constitute claims based on action or inaction. And then it says both of which are subject to indemnification, which Mr. Brooks argues isn't quite the same thing as whether it was assumed or not.
But the indemnification cases that he cite are when another party indemnifies a third party. Here, the only reason there is indemnification is because we're liable, which is a lot different than just doing it by contract. We're saying, we got it, we didn't pass it along, we're liable, you're right, we'll take over the defense. I mean, essentially what he's trying to do is get an interpretation of the contract that the parties don't agree to and essentially become a third-party beneficiary, which he is not to this particular contract, and there's no provision for it. So I think that basically in terms of what you said about sorting this out, they filed the claim about a month, the lawsuit about a month before the failure, and it was published, notice was published three times in the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah.
Yes,
right.
In state court. And the bar date was 90 days later. So in that particular time, they could have filed a claim, and that's what happens often, Your Honor. People don't know which party is the right party. They file a claim, and we do sort it out. And that's one of the reasons I think that Congress passed FURIA, to have the agency sort things out. So here, they didn't file a claim by the bar date, and under the statute, it's deemed disallowed. And under the following statute, the court has no jurisdiction over claims against the receiver that are based on acts or omission, which is what the letters indicate that this is based on. So they did not file a claim, and they can't get around by suing the acquirer, and this court lacks jurisdiction.
So if we were to find that, let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Brooks. Suppose we say nobody had jurisdiction, back to square one. Aren't this bank, I guess there's going to be a new lawsuit in state court or something? I mean, are we going to just repeat this cycle? Obviously, if we dismiss for want of jurisdiction, then in a sense nothing happened, right? So what's to prevent them from filing all over again against
MB?
Yeah, against MB.
Well, if they file a claim against MB, I mean, we would, again, argue that the state court doesn't have jurisdiction, because it's a claim really against us. If they're filing a claim against MB for something MB did after the receivership that had no tie to the bank's bad acts, that's a different matter. But
sure,
everything that they have put into their complaint, and even in their complaint to amend, all the acts they were asserting had dealt with the bad acts, or their alleged bad acts, of the bank in bank. So as a result, we ask that this court dismiss the appeal. But even if you were to find jurisdiction, we believe that the district court below properly found that the complaint did not state that an action under the interest law, the consumer fraud, or the unfair contract. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Brooks? I have one further question for you while you're walking up, which is if we were to give you the relief you're looking for here and you went back and tried to sue MB Financial in a new action, why wouldn't you be faced immediately with a preclusion defense, either claim or issue?
Well, Your Honor, that is exactly why we took this appeal, because I'm certain that MB Financial would argue that the district court's earlier ruling regarding the sufficiency of our allegations would somehow then preclude us from arguing that in any other court. And if this court was to find that there was somehow lack of jurisdiction with regards to the claims, administrative claims process, that they would argue somehow that also applies for MB Financial.
Well, you can actually have jurisdictional preclusion. If you have litigated the issue of jurisdiction and lost, and now you try to go back and litigate the issue of jurisdiction again, you could certainly have preclusion on that point.
And I'm sure they would attempt that, but I think there's an issue that hasn't been discussed much other than a comment just made by counsel, which is that if, in fact, my clients had alleged that MB Financial had done something itself after the receivership, that that would have nothing to do with their administrative claims process.
Right.
I'm glad to hear that concession because that's exactly what's alleged in our complaint. It is not restricted to just the acts of the predecessor bank. In fact, our complaint specifically alleges that MB Financial continued to use this sham interest rate after the FDIC sold the bank, and though the collected interest and principal and so forth and its actions to attempt to collect that interest and principal afterwards. In fact, our complaint seeks declaratory relief to reform those contracts which are still being held by MB Financial. It seeks injunctive relief to preclude MB Financial from using that interest index rate and from further attempts to collect that interest. Those are all acts of MB Financial that are completely independent of the FDIC or the predecessor bank. Those allegations are both in the original complaint and in the proposed amended complaint. So for those reasons, we feel that the FDIC's claims process is not applicable at all to MB Financial, and I wish I had more time to discuss it because I also think that the authority cited by the FDIC for the proposition that MB Financial is subject to protection as a result is also clearly distinguishable. It's a very recent decision, as Your Honors are probably aware of, which I would have loved an opportunity to delve into more. But
well, you have until the red light goes.
I understand that, but
rest assured that the court will read the.
If I can make it just very quickly, the three decisions that the Benson Court relies upon are completely distinguishable. None of them stand for the proposition that a third-party bank benefits from the FDIC's administrative claims process if those liabilities have been passed to the third party, and that's what occurred here. So for those reasons, I'd like that the district court's decision be reversed.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The court will take the case under advisement.